Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 20th of October. This hour of the program, why should we care about the future of small towns in the Heartland if many of them disappear and become latter-day ghost towns? What real difference will it make to most of our lives? Our guest this hour spent quite a bit of time in Iowa in a town that they call Ellis. It doesn't really exist, but they wanted to protect the privacy of the people whose lives they examined, particularly the young people in Ellis who were coming of age and looked at what the town did to offer or not offer, one or the other, a choice of a brilliant life for achievers, those who wanted to stay in the hometown. Were they prepared to be able to have jobs that supported families to stay there? And it looks at what's happening to many small towns across the country. This one, of course, looks at one in the middle, in the Midwest, where we are. And they talk about the fact that the Heartland matters because without the Heartland, the country couldn't function in the same way that a body cannot function without a heart. Our guests are the authors of Hollowing Out the Middle, The Rural Brain Drain, and What It Means for America. Patrick Carr is Associate Professor of Sociology at Rutgers University. Maria Kafalas, Associate Professor of Sociology at St. Joseph's University. Patrick and Maria, thank you very much for being with us. Hello, hello.
Good morning.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Good morning. Thanks so much for being with us. So, you went to Ellis, Iowa, and I found this a fascinating project. It's an interesting group of people to look at, those who are just about to become adults, and how the town prepared them for where they're going to go and where they decided to go. In some cases, it was ingrained pretty early in their lives, wasn't it?
Well, yes, absolutely. We had these wonderful conversations with parents and teachers and the young people, and they would often say that they felt that they were chosen to leave or chosen to stay or destined to stay, and that the parents themselves would look at their offspring and say, well, this is the one that's going to go away and go off to university and never look back, and this is the one who's going to stay close to home and marry her sweetheart and work the farm. And there was an incredible sense of a triaging, a sifting and sorting of who is going to stay and who is going to go.
Mm-hmm. Give us an overview, Patrick, because there's a lot of this kind of information in the book as well, about the health of small-town America. How many are losing huge numbers? How many have really had to fold up and disappear because nobody lives there anymore? There's nothing to do.
Well, the precise number of how many are close to extinction is hard to pin down, but just to give you an overview of some of the broader statistics, over 700 non-metro counties, so rural counties in middle America, lost 10% or more of their population between 1980 and 2000. Mm. In over half of all of those counties, there are more deaths than births. So you, and then there are other sort of indicators that you can kind of look at. So, for example, in the Midwest, how many non-metro counties have medically underserved areas so that, you know, that they don't have doctors or dentists or healthcare professionals anywhere near. And you see, again, the sort of concentration of these kinds of things. And then the last sort of indicator of a town that's sort of, you know, if not on the verge of extinction, certainly well in the way, is when you see schools that have to amalgamate or have to close because there aren't enough kids, basically, to keep a school open. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the precise numbers of towns is hard to pin down, but there are many towns that are like that, are on the way to being that, and that's, you can kind of see the trend in that direction.
Mm-hmm. And Professor Kafalas, that happened in Ellis, didn't it? They had to merge schools, they had to merge districts.
Absolutely, and they get to be the home base for the consolidation of schools, but I think that there is a growing sense that the clock is ticking, and that now that they're taking on a third community into the school system, at some point maybe they won't have enough children at their school, and they're going to have to start busing them. And that, I think, is a very terrifying prospect. And for folks in rural communities, it really is, I think, a sense that they could simply have to shutter the doors of the community and really just become a place where a couple people live and lose their identity once the school is absorbed into a bigger district. And it's very hard to get young families to move in to these communities when you're faced with that prospect. So I think that one of the great challenges is, where are these new young people going to come? And people are looking around to figure out where the new population growth is going to be. And ironically, for many communities throughout the Midwest, it has been through immigrants, and that has been the most kind of powerful and rapid way to increase population to a rural area that was otherwise depopulating.
Yeah. And talk a little bit about that historically. Governor Vilsack, I believe, was the one you mentioned in the book, who said immigrants are the way to build our population, to give jobs to people who, in these, many of these smaller towns, they don't want to do the jobs. Immigrants don't want to. But for a town, for towns that are pretty much white, actually, it's created what a difference to have immigrants, many people from South America, Central America, coming to your town. It's different, right? It's really different.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, the kind of immigration that we see in rural America is not like anything we've seen in Chicago or New York or Boston. It happens very quickly. Within a matter of just 5 years, you'll see a community go from 100% white to maybe where one in three residents is now not white. And so it's very rapid. They come through the school system, and often the schools are the place where you see these rapid transformations most dramatically, where suddenly the 100% white school is now 50% of immigrant groups, often from Guatemala, South America, Mexico, and increasingly from Somalia. And it provides really, really unique challenges. And I think one of the great struggles for much of the Midwest and much of the rural South will be, how do you integrate these populations? How do you reimagine rural America when, you know, in people's minds, it's the Music Man, it's a very distinctive image, it's the American Gothic, and then suddenly Somalis are living there.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was interesting, and they really must notice Somalis, was when you were walking down the streets in Ellis, I think you're half Greek, is that right? So, and they were looking at you wondering, who is this strange creature?
Oh, well, Pat is also Irish, and so he stood out quite a bit as well. But yes, it was really striking to see how that was going to be a big challenge for the community, and we experienced that when people kind of wondered what I was with my dark curly hair and olive skin, and people were very polite, but it was like we describe in the book, it was as if they had sighted a rare bird that didn't belong in their habitat. And I think it does really speak to the great challenges that they face in dealing with this new rural community that will probably be their best hope for survival.
Right. I'm just interested, before we talk about what it means to have these towns disappear, how difficult or easy it was for both of you, because you tell great stories about your next-door neighbor making sure that you cut the grass, and you guys weren't real familiar with grass cutting because you hadn't done it all the time. Did you find that everybody was staring out their windows looking at you all the time?
Well, I'm going to let Pat take that question because he has a better stories about how we came into the community.
Okay.
Yes and no. I think there was what I would call a robust and healthy curiosity about us, as I think any sort of strangers in a small town. And it quickly became apparent that, you know, we were doing a study and that, you know, this big foundation had decided that this was going to be a town that, you know, they were interested in finding out more about. So there was certainly a healthy curiosity. And I think, you know, at times, you know, you might feel a little self-conscious, but for the most part, you know, I think we were certainly welcomed and embraced. And the other, I think, thing that was maybe slightly different about our experience in Ellis was the fact that we had been there before. I mean, you know, I had a history of knowing people from the town. It wasn't a random sort of stick a pin in a map and we're going to go there. We sort of had ties to certain people in this town for many years before we started the research, and you know, that kind of, I think, eased our transition in. And, you know, we were a known quantity, and if so-and-so spoke highly of us, then we must be okay. And, you know, I think people after a while realized that, you know, we aren't the coastal elitists that people might make us out to be, that we're actually decent human beings too. And even though our lawn skills might be, you know, not the best, that we're willing to learn.
Right. And you did one great job after the first time, right? That lawn always was looking good after that.
There was great skepticism that we would be able to handle it about our lawn maintenance.
Yeah. Yeah. We did it in lines, the little patterns. You know, by the end of the summer, we had these patterns that we could do.
So. Did you like living there? Did either one of you think, boy, this is the kind of life that appeals to me?
Yeah, I think so. There were certain parts of it. I have to admit, the first couple of nights that we stayed in our house there, I was perturbed by the complete silence. It was really, it made me very uneasy, you know, having lived in the city for so long. You know, there was no traffic, there was no sirens, you know, and so on. So that was a little bit weird to get used to. But once you got used to it, it was kind of cool. You could see the stars, and it was, you know, you could walk downtown in 2 minutes, and, you know, it was a very comfortable lifestyle. Your door's always open, the kids are always out in the street, and their bikes are, you know, you can leave their bikes, and nobody's going to steal them, and, you know. So there was a lot that's, I think, very commendable about living there. And the other thing that we really loved was the fact that the soil in our back garden was so rich that even urbanites like ourselves could easily grow stuff and tasty stuff too, which was kind of very cool.
I love the story, Maria, of you're leaving. I think Patrick was gone somewhere and you left the street light. You left the light on at the house and somebody wondered, what in the world were you doing?
Yes. It was the first night I was there, and everyone was very concerned that I had left the front porch light on. And the owner of the house was called by the neighbor, who was concerned that, you know, that I didn't understand or was something wrong, that the light was still on. So, you know, I think people were absolutely, you know, very, very straightforward about their curiosity about us, and really kind of just in a very straightforward Midwestern way explaining to us what we were doing wrong. And how to correct it as efficiently as possible. And, you know, one of the things that's very interesting about, you know, as they sort of deal with this challenge of immigration was that some communities had created videos welcoming the immigrants to the community. So here are the, in Spanish, you'd have these videos on how you assimilate into life in a small town in Iowa. And they were, you know, suggestions about mowing your lawn, and please don't park your car on your front lawn, and so there were all these kind of wonderful, you know, welcoming guidebooks. Which, again, you know, you can't ever imagine anyone doing that in New York, handing out a video, "Welcome to New York."
Exactly.
Here's the rules of New Yorkers.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, in many ways, I think they were very much ahead of the curve. Some of the initiatives folks were doing to imagine how to welcome folks were really, you know, quite impressive and in clever.
What do people do in Ellis?
Well, the primary employers are a couple of factories in the area, and the town isn't far from John Deere in Waterloo, so a lot of folks do work in Waterloo. There are farmers, but as we talk about in the book, you know, I think one of the great misunderstandings in America is that, yes, we produce even more food than we did 20 years ago on farms, but only 2% of Americans farm. And of those 2% of that tiny group of folks who are farming, only 2% of American farms produce 50% of the food. So we've gone to this supersized agribusiness model, which has really, really emptied out communities. So the days of the 2,000-acre, 1,000-acre farm run by a family or kept in a family have really, really kind of disappeared and been replaced by basically a subcontracting system where absent corporations subcontract out the land. And so it's very, very hard to sustain that life. I mean, farming has always been challenging, but right now it's so, so completely different. And that has just completely, you know, I think undermined the fundamental kind of structure of these communities. If you can't farm, and factory work, as we know, there are 1.9 million factory jobs, manufacturing jobs, have disappeared since the recession started. And so those sectors are just so vulnerable, those jobs are disappearing. The ones that exist pay so little. So you see these communities really kind of sinking into this quicksand for the folks who stay.
And what about this new economy that we're supposed to see, green jobs, green energy, which it seems to me could flourish if money were put into it in places like Ellis? What about organic gardening? What about organic sustainable agriculture? Are they moving in that direction at all? Because we keep hearing that we are going to be moving in that direction.
Yeah, I think they're, you know, use the phrase that's very common right now, that you can see the green shoots with both of these areas that I think have terrific growth potential. Green energy, the alternative sources of energy are by their very nature, you know, they lend themselves to decentralization. You don't have to have them, and in fact, you can't really have them in the big cities. So wind energy, solar energy, hydroelectric, plants and so forth, you can have them all over the country. So there is the possibility for this to happen in small towns and in the Midwest. And one of the sort of pieces of evidence for the green shoots is, I think, the famous sort of refitting of the what was the Maytag plant in Newton, Iowa, which when it shuttered, really people felt that, well, you know, Newton's done, because here's a company that was the bellwether of this town and employed over half of the workforce and so on. And when they shut down, the people in Newton really, I think, worked very strenuously to kind of rethink, well, what can we do? We have this big plant. We need to, you know, get these people back to work. So they refitted it to produce wind turbines to produce clean energy, retrained most of the workforce, not all of it, but most of it, and got people back to work there. So there's that. In terms of sustainable agriculture, the Midwest, Iowa places, Wisconsin, really can and has to be ground zero for that. If we're serious about rethinking how we produce food, and I think we should be, because it's the right thing to do, both for the sort of health of the nation as a whole, and also in terms of bringing people back to the land. Polycultural farming is possible there. It doesn't have to be the mega farm that's producing vast quantities of corn and soybeans, and we're seeing the green shoots of this. So, for example, the community sustainable agricultural co-ops, there are many more of them now in the Midwest. There are, I've begun to see restaurants in Iowa City, for example, or we didn't see them 10 years ago, that advertise the fact that all of our food is locally grown, it's organic, it's grass-fed beef, and so on. So, so the shoots are there. It's having the sort of policies, I think, at the national level that truly encourage this, that offer the incentives, because, you have to invest fairly heavily now for alternative energy that's really going to pay off in about a decade. And that's an extraordinarily long time in political terms, because what politician thinks in terms of, well, if I do something now, we'll see the benefit in 10 years. Mm-hmm. It's a very difficult sell. The governor of Oregon was on NPR yesterday, and he was talking about this very issue. I think there is hope there. There is certainly the potential and the scope to really harness these two areas. I think that could be terrific ways to reinvigorate small towns and to bring people there to work in really sustainable jobs.
We have a number of people online already who would like to speak with you. We're talking with the authors of Hollowing Out the Middle, The Rural Brain Drain, and What It Means for America. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Patrick Carr, Associate Professor of Sociology at Rutgers University, and Maria Kafalas, who is Associate Professor of Sociology at St. Joseph's University, our guest this hour, the co-authors of the book. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have many people online, so let's start our phone calls with Rick, who's calling from Waukon, Iowa. Hi, Rick.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I work in agriculture as a consultant, and I see this issue as kind of America's dirty little secret, because if you go across South Dakota, North Dakota, there's thousands of towns that are just dead or dying, whatever. It's all because of the loss of the small family farm. And I tend to disagree with your idea that sustainable agriculture is going to change things, because most of the land has been gobbled up by these huge billionaires and millionaires, and they're committed to ethanol and biodiesel, and these are questionable as to whether or not they're sustainable. So, I think in this country we need some kind of land reform, just like in Brazil. I mean, it's gotten so concentrated with 10,000-acre farms, et cetera. So.
Can I respond to that?
Yes, go right ahead, Patrick.
I don't disagree, and I think you're absolutely right. The the solution may at the outset or on its surface may seem simple, but the actual process to get there is very, very difficult. You're absolutely right. And the trend towards the sort of massive consolidation in agriculture is, you know, almost overwhelming. But again, I think the fact that, you know, there are, you know, signs that there certainly is evidence of people who are trying to practice polyculture farming. My larger point is that we do need to reform policy. If that means land reform or if it means a move toward land reform, then I think that's what we have to do. But I think first and foremost, what needs to happen, and this has to come from central government, is, you know, a real effort to loosen the stranglehold that agribusiness has. I mean, they really have an unfair advantage. They've really had all the breaks. And, you know, and that occurs not just in terms of just the land itself, but in terms of the practices of their business. So the fact that they've driven down wages for workers, the fact that they, you know, are allowed in many states to operate plants that are largely unsafe and have, you know, in some cases, scores of violations, health and safety violations. I mean, these are the kinds of abuses that can easily be legislated for. And I think, again, there has to be a willingness to sort of say, look, you know, this can't go on the way it's going to go on, and that there are other ways, and if there is encouragement and, I think, incentives to move beyond that system, you know, I think you're right, it's going to be really very, very difficult, but I think it has to start somewhere.
Mm. And I don't know which comes first here, the jobs or preparing people to stay. You talk a lot in the book about the town of Ellis sowing the seeds of its own decline, getting people to move away because of their education and identifying high achievers, and they go to the University of Iowa or Iowa State or elsewhere and find new lives for themselves and don't come home. Does the place of Ellis really need to simultaneously work on getting more of their young people as they approach adulthood to stay, and then also work on giving them something to stay for?
We really believe strongly that the first step is to invest as heavily in the young people who stay as they do in the ones who go. Mm. And there has been this kind of chronic neglect, I think nationally, of young people who are not going to college, and this assumption that, well, if, you know, well, let's put all resources to get young people to 4-year colleges, and that's fine, and that's laudable. But you have all these other young people who are not going to college who need something in between a 4-year degree and a high school diploma. And so one of the suggestions we have is for educators and local economies and, you know, chambers of commerce is invest in your young people who stay, which means that for the young people who are not going to 4-year colleges, spend as much time preparing them to enter the labor force as you do with the young people who are going off to college, and you spend with them preparing for that transition. So in terms of retooling the regional economy, we really want to see much more kind of a matchup between, well, you know, Iowa's going to need nurses, and Iowa's going to need dental hygienists, Iowa's going to need engineers to build wind turbines, and working with high schools and community colleges to get young people on that track to prepare for this new economy, as opposed to just letting them leave high school with their diploma and try to find a job at the plant. But I wanted to quickly get back to Rick's point about reform and point out that right now in Wisconsin, the Attorney General of the U.S. Attorney General is currently suing the huge dairy cartels that have done exactly what he's describing in terms of just consolidating the dairy farm industry and putting it in the hands of a very powerful kind of, you know, international corporations, and are trying to break the monopoly. So there is a beginning, I think, a growing realization on the national level that these farming agribusinesses are operating like cartels and that they need to be treated like monopolies, mm-hmm. and broken apart. So that, mm-hmm. that, I think, may happen before land reform, and that may be the best way to go. And it's very promising to see Washington getting into that battle right now.
Let's go to Eugene from Viola next. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Kathleen. A comment on your last show about the gentleman who called in about lying. The Irish have been doing that for centuries with their storytelling. But this area here, this is kind of a mixed bag. we've got the national headquarters for Organic Valley 6 miles north of us, so they have managed to keep some young people around. Mm-hmm. And we've got a vocational school at Baroqua. But still, at the same time, you go either way out of this village here within 5 miles, and I can count a dozen farms that are just gone. You've had a lot of people from out of state bought up these small farms. But they've also got a vocational school at Baroqua, which is 13 miles west of us, is doing some training, pretty much. And the school districts here are hurting a little bit. Then up north of us, there's about 25, 30 miles, there's a small village up there. They've got a packing plant, and they had some people from Mexico and also from Latin America move in there, and they did have some problems when they went to work at the packing plant. It's been a mixed bag in this area.
What kinds of problems did they have, Eugene?
They had racial problems, mm-hmm. a little bit.
Patrick, you want to take this one?
Sure. I think these comments are illustrative of, you know, the sort of patchwork of what's going on out there. There are places in which, you know, things are going okay, or they're holding on, or they're finding ways to keep people and or attract people there. And there are places that, you know, are as Maria spoke about earlier on, have become points of entry for immigrants. And that transition is a very difficult one because, you know, and again, it's the pace of this rapid change. It's an influx of non-natives who may not speak English well or so on. And for that to work in a sustainable way, there has to be, you know, real assimilation. And I think one of the barriers towards assimilation has been a lot of the workers that have come in to Midwestern towns, I'm thinking about Storm Lake, I'm thinking about Postville and so on, have at the same time, as they have done so, they have been enticed in by agribusiness, and agribusiness has used basically this labor force to depress wages. So, for example, the wages for a meat packer in the industry in Iowa are in the sort of recent times are about a third of what they were 12 or 15 years ago, which is absolutely staggering, if you say, to depress wages that much. And they can do it because they have, you know, this surplus pool of cheap labor. So when native workers see that, say, look, oh, these guys arrived and they drove my wages down and they've made these jobs, you know, practically, not that they're great jobs to begin with, but now they're really terrible jobs and they don't have any benefits. And so the non-natives are then sort of associated with this, you know, huge drop in living standards. And again, you know, that's one way to view it, and that can lead to resentment and so on. And then the other issue with respect to, you know, the large numbers of non-natives moving in is that while this can be an economic transformation that can be very beneficial in terms of, you know, restarting what can be a moribund local economy, you also have, you know, a tendency towards ghettoization, where there is very little contact between natives and non-natives, and that's, you know, that is a mistake. That's certainly something that can lead to the kinds of problems that Eugene is talking about. Mm-hmm. So it's something that you have to be very careful of about you. It's something that has to be managed very well, and there are examples of that happening around the country. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a bad story.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the number of young people who chose the armed forces as a way to see the world, and they didn't really want to go to college, but they had a sense of adventure about them. And they do, small-town America, provide a number of people who serve in the Army, in the Navy, in the Marines, right?
Absolutely. About a tenth of the young people that we interviewed were currently serving or had served in one of the branches of the military. And for those who want to leave a small town and see the world, and some do come back, some circle back, some use the military as a way to sort of stay away. But for those who are not the sort of achievers, who are not the college band, who don't receive the sort of intensive mentoring and cultivation that the achievers do, the military is the only other way out. And, you know, part of this is that, again, this is an established pathway for a lot of families. You have, some of the young people we spoke with were second, third generation, you know, Marines or, you know, who served in the Navy, and their parents and grandparents did also. So part of it is that, but, you know, it really is an avenue for them. And what's interesting about that is that for those who return, there is a sense that, you know, after their military service, they feel a little bit that, not that they were duped in any major way, but that they don't have the skills and credentials that they really need, you know, that they haven't gotten the sort of specialized training that they need to be able to be competitive in the kind of modern economy that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And that is an issue. So, you know, some we talked about who had finished their service were trying to retrain and didn't have the skills or didn't have enough credits to become a nurse or whatever it was, you know, and so on. So that's a difficulty for, you know, the returning veterans, you know, that, you know, they just don't feel prepared enough to be able to get a good job after they finish their military service.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the achievers for a moment. And I'm interested in if any of them do come back and how much emphasis is put on grooming them for life out of Ellis, Maria?
Yes. Well, you know, I think one of the paradoxes, one of the dilemmas that so many small towns face is that you hear this expression all over the Midwest, we're really good at raising kids, and we then proceed to export them out of our communities. And there's a great point of pride of that, about that, that you can send your young people away to college and they do great things. And everyone wants to say they knew the small town kid before they made it big.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, and that has been a model for 100 years, that, you know, you send your young people away. But now it really has reached a tipping point. The educational realities of today's economy mean that going to college is no longer a luxury. It's absolutely a necessity for competing in this economy, for being middle class. And so you have this situation where this kind of time-honored tradition, which small towns took great pride in, has now kind of become a slow suicide for the community. And now they find themselves basically evacuating the kids that they can get out and doing the best they can by the ones that remain. And they sort of, they're aware of this. And I think one of the really powerful kind of striking parts of the book, or our experience with the book, is, you know, people just keep writing us and telling us amazing stories about how I was one of those achievers and how I feel great obligation and affection for my hometown, but I don't want to go back.
Right.
And then the folks who stay really feeling left behind, and there's almost like this survivor's guilt of I got out and I got ahead, but my brothers and sisters stayed, and things are really bad for them, and the community is worse off because people like me have left. And I don't know how you get young people to turn around and move back home. I think that there is a way to cultivate more of a, you know, of a sense that staying is okay, staying is valuable, staying will be rewarded. But at the same time, I don't think for some young people this is how it's supposed to be. But I think that communities can market themselves more effectively. And I also think that investing in the young people who are staying is really the necessary first
mm-hmm.
step.
Let's go to Roger next from Fitchburg. Hi, Roger.
Hi. I think small towns would disappear much faster if we expect Federal Express and UPS and other private carriers could replace the United States Postal Service. The Postal Service delivers to any place in the country for 42 cents an envelope, much less than that for the bulk mail, which keeps a lot of small businesses going in nonprofits and so forth. So I think we've got to maintain the United States Postal Service. It's critical to the survival of small towns.
Hmm. That's an interesting point. Patrick?
Yes.
Maria, go ahead.
Well, I think you have, I think that brings up a lot of, a lot of issues that these towns need lifelines to the outside world. And one of the, actually, another huge challenge, not in addition to the that questions about the Postal Service and what it will look like in the next 5 or 10 years are the digital divide and creating a digital infrastructure so that folks can do work and access the Internet and have reliable kind of service that makes it possible for local economies and local entrepreneurs really to develop those opportunities. And so there's some interesting cases of communities that have really gambled and said, we are going to make our community a completely, you know, top-of-the-line wireless community and make sure our young people know how to use computers so that we are part of this new world where, you know, the digital is an everyday reality. You can't just opt out of it. So I think that, you know, the infrastructure issues for these communities are absolutely key.
Yeah. Jack from Random Lake. Hi.
Hi. Hi. The author's comments on, you know, turning off the porch lights, and then I think there was something about difficulty sleeping due to the quiet or lack of sirens. You know, like without this, with a little disrespect here, is that not a something of a nature deficit disorder? I mean, the fact that, you know, and culturally, you know, I've always thought you could take a person from the country and he could better or she could better assimilate into metropolitan life as a vice versa. And I don't mean to be derogatory in any way, but I think part of what the rural communities do offer and where people actually do migrate back is that the peacefulness and the, I don't know if it's a slower pace or if it's a more relaxed pace, or maybe it's, I mean, for like elderly drivers, maybe for a good example would be, you know, would you rather have your elderly parent driving in, you know, four lanes of traffic, rush hour traffic, or on a rural road that's, you know, sparsely used? And I'll just leave my comments there.
Okay.
No offense taken at all.
There's a lot
that is, you know, entirely wonderful about living in a small town. It's more interesting, I think, what your comment sort of speaks to in terms of, you know, enticing people and you know, what's interesting about it is that the state of Iowa has a campaign to bring back, you know, sort of young professional workers. And they use precisely the sort of the imagery that you're using there right now. So, for example, one of their taglines is, you know, commutes that can be measured in minutes instead of, you know, hours. And that's certainly true. I don't remember being in a traffic jam for the time we spent now, which was great. You know, and I commute 85 miles each way to work in New Brunswick. So, you know, I'm in traffic all the time. And I miss those days. You know, I miss those empty roads. And, you know, so, you know, there is certainly the quality of life is different, and depending on what you want, it can be something that can entice people back. But what was very interesting about the group that we call high flyers, these are the returners who are very, very much sought after by small towns, so people who are medical professionals or lawyers or entrepreneurs and so on, the basically achievers who come home. And every state wants to bring more in. You know, they're trying to lure professionals back or keep them by sort of saying, you know, we'll give you loan forgiveness, or in Kansas they have a free land program for people or whatever it is. And all of those things are very interesting. But what was fascinating to us is when we spoke with the small number of high flyers that were in our group, it really was intensely personal reasons that they came back. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't an incentive program. It wasn't loan forgiveness. It wasn't, you know, tuition remission or anything like that. It was the fact that, you know, well, I want to come back because, you know, it's what you describe. You know, it is that quality of life issue. I want to be close to my family. I want to, you know, have my kids grow up in the same kind of place that I grew up in. So how you match up the programs with these intensely personal reasons is a real struggle, because I think states still think that, you know, there has to be goodies on the table, whereas in actual fact it really boils down to how that person feels and the decision they make to often work against their economic interest, earn less money to move back to a town that, you know, is very like the one they grew up in, if not the one where they came from.
I'm interested, Patrick, first in you, because from listening to you for quite a while now, I assume that you grew up in Ireland or spent a good portion of your youth in Ireland. Did you?
I did. I'm a leaver also.
I was wondering.
I'm an immigrant too, so I don't know what box you can fit me in. I'm in all sorts of different boxes. Yeah.
Did you grow up in a rural part of the country, or
I actually didn't. I grew up in a grimy industrial town between Dublin and Belfast.
Although
my mother grew up in a small town in the west, so
that's why I had to mow the lawn,
spent a lot of time in sort of small village Ireland, but only in the summertime. You know, when we'd be packed off and go down to where my mother came from, which was Kilkee on the west coast.
Mm-hmm. And what about you, Maria?
I'm from Boston, but my mother is an immigrant from the West Indies and the Caribbean island of St. Lucia. And my father is from Greece. And my favorite story about moving to Iowa is my father, when he heard that we were moving to Iowa, and he'd only really lived on the coast. And he said, "Oh, you're going to be living in the real America." And so, I mean, it's just so powerful that even my parents, who never visited us, unfortunately, but Pat's family has actually been to Ellis. But there's this incredible sense of people who've never even been to the heartland that this is the real America.
Well, there's something to be said for that as a life. Yeah, I've lived in other parts of the country, but I really think there's something about the Midwest that, you know, it's grounding, it's real, there's not a lot of pretension here. As you note, we've given the nation a lot of presidents. There, can you describe what you feel when you're here? There's something about the real, I think, that exists in the Midwest.
Oh, absolutely. It's very, it was very interesting. I'll admit it was very hard for me to adjust. And it was funny what I missed. And, you know, I guess the caller who made the point that urbanites have more trouble adjusting to small towns than small town folks adjusting to the city. I think it was incredible to me that everyone knew who I was, and everyone everyone knew what I was doing, and would kind of come up to you and talk to you on the street. And as someone who lives in cities, you know, people talking to you on the street is usually a sign to run away. And those kinds of things were difficult for me to adjust to, and the fact that there was this incredible level of knowledge and intimacy. I describe it like living in a town of psychics, where everyone knows who you are and everything about you, and they know your parents and your grandparents. And so I think that is, at one point, the incredible gift of living in a place like that, but also for some folks, the great challenge of it, that mm-hmm. they often maybe feel like an outsider or they don't fit in. So for people who adapt to it and feel like they belong, this can be the greatest gift. But I think for other people, it can be a bit much, especially when everyone knows who you are and has kind of decided your fate. So I think that's
right. Well said. We're talking with the authors of Hollowing Out the Middle, The Rural Brain Drain and What It Means for America. Maria Kafalas is with us. She is Associate Professor of Sociology at St. Joseph's University, also author of Working Class Heroes and co-author of Promises I Can Keep. Patrick Carr, Associate Professor of Sociology at Rutgers University and the author of Clean Streets. We'll take more phone calls in a moment on the Ideas Network. We return to your phone calls. Michael from Rice Lake is next. Hi, Michael.
Hi, good morning. First, I want to caution your guests not to elaborate too much about our quality of life here, because we don't want to have a huge influx of, you know, coastal people coming out here. On the other hand, you've mentioned several times about investing in the young people that stay in these small communities, and I'm wondering just how you can go about doing that, because the primary tool for investing in the kids that go off to college are student loans, and they end up paying those back, but what equivalent tool can we use to invest in keeping them in town? You know, right now, I don't think there's a starter loan that you can get to go get an apartment or your first car when you don't have a job and job outlooks are pretty poor. So I'm just curious, what ideas might you have for investing in the students to stay local?
Well, we actually want it to start before they go out into the job market, and really to cultivate young people who are staying and who are not headed to four-year colleges. So, for example, I mean, when right now, I think for the achievers in many communities, for the kids who are leaving and going to college, there are incredible investments to prepare them for college. Teachers take extra time to tutor them. Folks will work together to get scholarship money so that they can go study in Germany for the summer before they go to college. And so there are these incredible resources of individuals that are really geared towards let's get our young people out and succeeding. And the young people who stay rarely describe any sort of investment like that. They talk about people who people didn't even really kind of nearly as much come and shake them, you know, grab them by the shoulder and say, you need to get your head on straight and here's what you need to do. So one of the things we would like to do is kind of developing professional, pre-professional vocational training for kids who are not going to college. So, for example, nursing programs in community colleges or the engineering and wind technology engineering programs, which are all housed in community college. So the first step would be identifying high school students and getting them ready for community college training that will lead towards jobs in the local economy and working with local business people about, well, this is what we need, this is what we want to develop, and creating resources just the same way, as you say, for student loans, for students to go to college, but also for students to go to work in two-year programs in local community colleges and then prepare them for this new local economy. So it really requires matching up local business, regional economic plans, community college and high school groups that don't normally work together.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Michael, so much for your interesting call. We go next to Bobby from Stevens Point. Hi, Bobby.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me on. I have a couple comments I'll blast at you, and maybe you can respond more so than a question. I'm involved in local food and the local attempt to you know, get sustainable agriculture really going to the point where it can provide a real sustainable livelihood for young people here in a small college city in the middle of Wisconsin. And I think that you're going to find that middle America, small town, is the actual outside world that people are going to want to escape into. And I'll tell you why, because we see already the bloom is definitely off the rose in places like California and New York and generally the coast and any place that's had a real estate bubble. I think we've reached the point of peak credit and peak oil, and this is going to force a complete recreation of an economy. So I think the old-fashioned farmer's idea that you used to hear from farmers' organizations that agriculture really is the foundation of your economy. So I think we have to begin preparing young people for careers that will at least exist, like growing food and processing food, because I think a lot of the things that we're preparing young people for now, a lot of this high technology bubble economy stuff, we may be graduating a whole bunch of people that may have very little to no job prospects for a decade or more. So this is my comment, that we are in the real world out here. This is the outside world. This is where people need to be.
Patrick, you want to take this?
Absolutely. I think the wider point that you speak to is essentially correct. I think there is a tremendous opportunity now to really think about how do you remake, you know, both the local economies and link them into regional economies and do so in ways that help small towns, you know, thrive again and grow. I'm not so sure that the sort of technology is going to disappear or the jobs in technology. I think there's going to be, you know, certainly different jobs. And I think one of the challenges here, particularly for small towns and for regions, you know, that have a lot of small towns, is matching up people and imbuing them with the kinds of resources that will enable them to be trained to get these jobs and to be able to, again, to, you know, think of the things that by their very nature can be decentralized. You know, when we talked about, you know, the green economy initiatives earlier on, that's certainly one of them. Community supported agriculture is certainly another one. And I think you're essentially right to say that, you know, that there, I think, you know, again, with the sort of how we produce food, I think we have an opportunity now to rethink this. You know, we rethought it in the 1970s when we sort of moved towards the, you know, mass production of corn. you know, as the sort of the bedrock of agriculture. So I see the scope to do that. And one other, if I could just address the previous caller's
sure.
point, just to add one little thing to that. President Obama announced the College Graduation Initiative in July of this year, where they've set aside $12 billion to revamp and to rethink what community colleges can do. And part of that money will be for scholarships. Part of that money will be to develop community colleges. Part of that money will be to again, remake the curriculum to be, you know, again, relevant for the 21st century. So I think there's money there, and there's certainly supports that can, as I said, by their very nature, be you know, something that small towns can avail on. So there is hope.
Yeah. Thank you both so much for being with us. You had a perfect audience, because people calling from small towns all over Iowa and Wisconsin. And thank you for the book. It was great research and ideas. Our thanks to Patrick Carr and Maria Kafalas. They are authors of Hollowing Out the Middle, The Rural Brain Drain and What It Means for America. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this program, and Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our studios. Until tomorrow.